From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Scott Pruitt, Attorney General for the great oil and gas state of Oklahoma, says climate change needs more debate and has fought a signature Obama environmental plan all the way to the Supreme Court. Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington is cut from the same cloth. Last week, Donald Trump picked Pruitt for the EPA and McMorris Rogers for the Interior Department. We've got the chief of ExxonMobil in the wings as potential Secretary of State. What comes next? This hour on Point, Donald Trump's incoming crew and the environment. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. What do you see in these picks? Foxes in the henhouse? Or a move to streamline the EPA bureaucracy and keep energy cheap in America? Is this the fossil fuel industry's last stand? Is this the planet's last chance? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at OnPoint Radio. In a few minutes, we'll speak with Trump environmentalist policy backer C. Boyden Gray and a key voice in the environmental movement, Bill McKibben. Right now, Emily Holden joins us from Washington. She's a reporter for E&E News, Climate Wire, and Power Plan Hub. E&E is a trade journal that covers environmental and energy policy and markets. Emily Holden, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Can we look at these first? I mean, let's just leave aside for the moment Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, who may be the president-elect's pick as Secretary of State. Over the weekend, a lot of commentary that he may be the front runner there for now. But let's look at the EPA and at the Department of Interior. Start with Scott Pruitt. What was his role? What has been his role in stopping the Obama plan to, or the Clean Power plan to get coal out of our, more or less, out of our power generation system?
So Scott Pruitt has led the attack on the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama administration's plan to curb greenhouse gas emissions from the power sector, not to eliminate coal entirely, but to continue to encourage a shift away from coal and toward natural gas and renewable power. And aside from just leading that challenge, which is what caused the Supreme Court to actually put that rule on hold until the other courts decide, determine whether it's legal. He, according to our reporting, has had lawsuits against EPA on behalf of Oklahoma and EPA and other environmental agencies at least 8 times. He also has strong ties to fossil fuel companies from his home state.
So he's got the blocks put to that. He's called everything from someone who says climate change needs debate to a climate change denier. How do you understand Scott Pruitt on the very subject of man-made climate change, Emily?
Well, you know, he has actually sort of avoided going on the record on this except for a couple of times. And one of those was in a co-authored op-ed that he wrote with another Republican attorney general, where he essentially said that, you know, this is an unsettled policy debate and it's something that we'll have to keep talking about. But if you look at his broader actions and the lawsuits that he's brought against EPA, I think that tells you a little bit more. There also was a very good story from the New York Times that he had actually taken some letters from industry companies that they wanted sent to EPA and essentially made very few changes to them and put them on his own letterhead and sent them to EPA.
And then step back and look at the Congresswoman McMorris Rogers, Kathy McMorris Rogers from Washington State. She's lined up for the Interior Department. Where does she see drilling, use of federal lands, the environment and climate?
Right. So environmental advocates have told us that some have said she's not an outright climate denier. She's questioned the science. Others have said, look, she's definitely pro-extraction. She said that she would support some offshore drilling on federal lands. She's also a hydropower supporter. So you really have to look at her full record there, too.
Full record. What about selling federal lands? Is that part of her brief or would be?
Expanding fossil fuel production on federal lands, I think we can definitely expect that.
So if you put these two together, and if they're able to carry out the visions that we understand they have coming in, if indeed they end up in these positions, what kind of change would it mean for Obama energy policy?
Well, there are a number of things that President-elect Trump has said that he wants to change about the Obama administration's policy on this. You know, he wants to expand fossil fuel production on public lands, especially. He wants to rescind these greenhouse gas limits that we've talked about. He wants to exit the Paris climate deal. And there are a lot of things that industry is asking for that they want that they would be very happy to get. And we can get into that a little bit more. But essentially, the markets are definitely moving toward cleaner power. That's going to keep happening. He can slow that down. Some of these policies can certainly slow that down, but that greater trajectory is going to continue.
Does that he's promised a lot of jobs, 500,000 jobs a year or more, out of a revived energy sector. What does the likelihood look like of that? Let's say even if we see all of these changes coming to pass in Obama-era environmental policy.
Well, especially if you look at the promises that he's made to the coal community, that is going to be very difficult for him to do. If you look at even if you rescind the Clean Power Plan, you'll essentially see coal use for electricity in the U.S. sort of flatline, maybe go down a few percentage points anyway, from about 30% of electricity in the U.S. to or 33% to about 30%. So you really can't tell power companies in the U.S. to build new coal plants. That's not something they're going to want to do. You can sort of slow the bleed there, but you can't revive that industry.
Here's Donald Trump interviewed yesterday on Fox News Sunday by Chris Wallace there. Wallace began by saying he'd never seen a presidential transition like the one currently underway. He gave the example of Trump's cabinet picks, including Scott Pruitt for the EPA.
You have named cabinet heads, department agency people, at EPA, at labor, at health and human services, education, who are diametrically opposed to what those agencies have been doing for the last 8 years. Fair to say that you're going to take a wrecking ball to the Obama legacy?
No, I don't want to do that at all. I just want what's right. EPA, you can't get things approved.
A wrecking ball. If you look at, in total, what's been promised on the campaign trail and the positions of these two picks, coming in or nominated, does it look like a flip, a wrecking ball in the waiting, Emily?
Well, you know, environmental advocates, they would say yes, but they would also say that you have to look to corporations. Almost all major corporations have a carbon price that they consider, and they make their business decisions based on that. And they're looking out past the Trump administration.
What do you mean by that exactly? Are you saying they consider the overall social price of carbon emissions or just the corporate bottom line price?
They're looking at how much it might cost them, you know, if they're investing in fossil fuels, how much it might cost them in regulations later on and rules later on, right? And so they're assuming that there's going to be international action on this.
But maybe that's not true. If Donald Trump does succeed in pulling the U.S. out of the Paris Agreement, does that agreement collapse?
Mm-hmm. Well, you've seen countries so far say we will keep working on this without him. But that's a true question. We would have to see exactly what it is that he wants to do. He has said repeatedly that he would keep an open mind on this, but only if it means that the U.S. is not going to be at a competitive disadvantage with other countries. So we don't really know exactly what that means yet.
And what about the role of the EPA itself? Here's Oklahoma's Attorney General Scott Pruitt. Trump's pick to head up the EPA. This was in May this year, testifying before Congress and talking about his perspective on the very purpose of the EPA.
The EPA was never intended to be our nation's foremost environmental regulator. The states were to have regulatory primacy. That construct, a construct put in place by this body, has been turned upside down by the current administration.
The states were to have regulatory primacy. This has been Scott Pruitt's sort of campaigning point for a long time. If that's true, if oversight on the environment is turned back to the states, what would the implications be, Emily?
Well, the states are pretty split on this. You have leaders on this, like California, like a lot of states in the Northeast, who have been working to curb their greenhouse gas emissions for a while. And then you have states in the middle of the country that really oppose switching away from coal power. But again, you have to look at the markets here. And even though they oppose that shift, it's likely that it's still going to be happening because natural gas is very cheap and it is competitive, very competitive with coal. And as I was saying before, you know, power companies, when they're making this decision, do I build a new coal plant or do I build a new natural gas plant or invest in renewable power? That's a pretty easy decision for them. And we've been seeing them make that decision, not for coal, for years now.
What about the wider picture of pollution? The EPA's had a lot of oversight there. Scott Pruitt has fought to rein in the scope of federal regulation over pollution of rivers under the Waters of the United States rule. How do you monitor pollution of riverways, which of course flow between states, from the state level?
That's a good question. A lot of the environmental groups have pushed back against his claim that, you know, the air and water in Oklahoma and his home state that it's actually stayed very clean and would under state regulation. I don't know that a lot of people necessarily believe that. It depends, you know, state by state on how state regulators view this and what measures they're willing to take, and also, you know, how friendly they actually are with industry, and also what kind of pushback they're getting from environmental groups.
What's your sense at the Secretary of State level? We don't know where that's going to go yet, but Rex Tillerson out front over the weekend as the nominee there, CEO of ExxonMobil, the biggest oil company in the world. What about, I mean, he's going to represent the United States if he takes that post. What about his statements on climate change, Emily? Are you aware of his position?
Yeah, that's interesting because ExxonMobil is a company that has said that it would advocate for a carbon price that acknowledges climate change. With him personally, I think it might be a little bit more complicated. He said that humans essentially could adapt to climate change, that it's just it's an engineering problem. But when you look at when he's speaking for the company, he has acknowledged it as an issue. A bigger issue with him, I think, is, you know, his close connections with President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Some Republicans in the Senate already said over the weekend that that's something that they would be really concerned about, that because of his business dealings, that he might not be able to deal with Russia without that being a conflict of interest.
Is he seen, if he were to be ultimately nominated and approved as Secretary of State, would he have much role in U.S. energy policy, environmental policy?
Oh, absolutely. The Secretary of State has a big role in discussions with other countries about, you know, climate policy and greenhouse gas reductions that they're willing to make. So, absolutely.
Emily Holden is reporter for E&E News, Climate Wire, Power Plan Hub. Emily, thanks for joining us today, getting us started here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the incoming Trump administration and the environment. His pick, Scott Pruitt, to head the EPA, Kathy McMorris-Rogers, to head the Department of Interior, perhaps the head of ExxonMobil, the CEO of the world's largest oil company, Rex Tillerson, as Secretary of State. You can join us this hour. What do you see shaping up for environmental policy, for the environment itself, in the Trump team? In the waiting here is the man who's fighting the EPA all the way to the Supreme Court, the man you want running the agency. Do you want Obama policy on the environment flipped upside down? Here's a little more of President-elect Trump yesterday on Fox. Chris Wallace asked him, looked at some contradiction in his statements on climate change and asked him, which is it? He says, on the one hand, you meet with Al Gore and Leonardo DiCaprio. On the other, you pick Scott Pruitt. On the one hand, you call climate change a hoax.
On the other hand, you told the New York Times that you're open-minded about it.
I am open-minded.
So where are you on the environment?
I'm still open-minded. Nobody really knows. Look, I'm somebody that gets it. And nobody really knows. It's not something that's so hard and fast. I do know this. Other countries are eating our lunch.
That's going to stop, says Donald Trump. But exactly what would these policies produce, both on that front and in terms of the environment itself? The Paris Climate Agreement, the big global effort to rein in climate change. Here was Donald Trump at the annual Williston Basin Petroleum Conference. This was in Bismarck, North Dakota in May. Vowed to get out of the Paris Climate Agreement. Said he would stop payments to the UN fund for programs to fight climate change.
We're going to cancel the Paris Climate Agreement and stop. Unbelievable. And stop all payments of the United States tax dollars to UN global warming programs.
Of course, the U.S. can't exactly cancel the Paris Agreement. It's a global agreement, but U.S. Foot dragging or pullout would be a very, very big deal right there. We're going to hear in a few minutes from Ambassador C. Boyden Gray, who's been close to the Trump transition team on environmental and energy policy. With us right now from the studios of Middlebury College in Vermont is Bill McKibben, author, environmentalist, founder of 350.org, advocates for measures to reverse climate change. He's a distinguished scholar at Middlebury College. Bill McKibben, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Hey, as always, Tom.
What do you see shaping up in the Trump view of climate and environment, and in particular in these picks that we see so far, Bill?
Let me back up just a minute. You and I have talked many times over the years, mm-hmm. And, I understand how it's supposed to go, that one side lays out their side, the other side we talk to and reach someplace in the middle.
I don't know if it's going to be that.
This doesn't feel like a kind of normal situation to me. Let me just talk for a minute, just get off my chest what we've watched a campaign where Mr. Trump went after women and racial minorities in the crudest and most disgusting terms. With the help of the antiquated Electoral College, he's managed to take power despite losing by almost 3 million votes. In the days since he took power, he's named an unprecedented number of his big campaign contributors to cabinet posts. He apparently is ready to offer the Secretary of State to the head of the biggest oil company in the world, despite the fact that that head of Exxon has taken awards from the Russian government that may well have hacked our election to his benefit. He's decided that he's not going to take intelligence briefings very often because, as he pointed out, I'm a smart guy. He lashes out on Twitter whenever anybody crosses him. All of this completely abnormal and gross behavior culminates in his attack on science and on reason when it comes to climate change, the deepest issue that we face. Look what he's done. His appointees to run the transition team at places like the Department of Energy are busily compiling a blacklist of anyone who's had anything to do with climate science or has attended any international meetings. He said yesterday, as you pointed out, that no one knows whether climate change was true or not. This is nonsense. Everybody, I mean everybody who studies this question, every climatologist understands that we, by burning coal and gas and oil, have put enough carbon in the atmosphere that we've raised the temperature. This year sets a new record for the entirety of human civilization. We now look up at the Arctic and down at the Antarctic and see that sea ice levels are at absolute record lows. And yet he's talking about canceling the one global agreement that was signed by 192 heads of state. He's going to unilaterally withdraw our participation on it. I guess all I'm saying is I'm not entirely sure how to coherently carry on this conversation as if these were just normal times. I don't envy you for having to figure out how to do it every day, but I think the place where it's maybe hardest of all is around these questions of climate science.
I mean, there's no requirement that any time be seen as a normal time. But it is the time we live in, and this is the incoming administration, and we're trying to get our heads around the implications of that. And as you say, there's an enormous context here. The impact on the environmental front, Donald Trump has said he wants it to be very large. He wants big change.
That's right. The context in which he said it is at the moment when the climate around us is literally falling apart. I mean, 2014 set the record for heat on this planet until it was smashed in 2015, and then that was smashed in 2016. We're now seeing around the world someplace every day record drought or record flood or record fire in places where we've never seen that happen before. And into that comes a guy who's only allegiance, so far as we can tell, is to the fossil fuel industry whose servants he has now appointed. And look at those people. I mean, you talked about Mr. Pruitt to head the EPA. It's not just that he's, comes from Oklahoma and so he favors the fossil fuel industry. He is literally a stenographer for that industry. He filed letters with the White House and the EPA that were later found out to have been Xerox copies of letters provided for him by fossil fuel companies within his state. His state of Oklahoma, with him in its government defending the industry every inch of the way, has gone from being a place where there were no earthquakes to being the most seismically active part of the United States because wastewater from frack wells injected into its geology are causing earthquakes 2, 3, 4 times a day, some of them big. What did Oklahoma, where Mr. Pruitt comes from, do about this? It held a day of prayer earlier this year in order to ask God to increase the price of oil so that the economy of the oil patch would improve. We're not talking – I guess what I'm trying to say is this just doesn't – it just doesn't feel like normal back and forth where we're going to find someplace in the middle. It feels like we're going over a cliff and going over it fast, and that the only thing that I can think of in that kind of situation to do is try and resist in the ways that we can. That's what we'll try to do at places like 350.org.
We're going to get another perspective here in just a moment from C. Boyden Gray. If these measures go through, if the Clean Power Plan is turned around, tossed out, if the U.S. should pull out of the Paris Agreement, if that's what you think really is in mind here, or maybe that's a negotiating strategy, I don't know. If the Keystone Pipeline, you and your group fought very hard against that, and maybe could that be back on the table? If we have a lot more drilling on federal lands in the West under a new Secretary of Interior, Kathy McMorris Rodgers, how do you see the net effect, Bill?
We're miles behind already in the climate fight. It's not like we were winning this under the Obama administration. There had been in the last couple of years, culminating in that Paris Agreement, a certain amount of momentum developing in the direction of clean energy, partly because the engineers have done such a good job of bringing down the price of solar power and wind power, something that has the fossil fuel industry running very, very scared. That momentum will at some level continue. People are not going to toss out their solar panels or, you know, turn their back on the technologies of the future. But this has always been a question about pace, about trajectory. Is it possible for us to move to renewable energy fast enough to even begin to catch up with physics? And clearly, the Trump administration is building a big ditch in that road, if not a crevasse. I think probably, as climate scientists have been saying over the last few weeks, that they'll be able to slow things down enough that we will never have the chance of catching up with that physics, that this is a change of administration and of ideology that will be measured in geologic time, because it's going to be a hell of a lot to ask the other countries of the world to continue moving ahead to battle climate change when the country that has poured more carbon and more methane into the atmosphere historically than any other is deciding that it doesn't want to play anymore.
Bill McKibben, stand by, if you would, there in Vermont. With us right now from Washington is Ambassador C. Boyden Gray. Under the first President Bush, he worked on the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990, the Energy Policy Act of 92, that was in a cap-and-trade system for acid rain emissions. Under George W. Bush, he was Ambassador to the European Union, U.S. Special Envoy to Europe for Eurasian Energy, founding partner of law at the Boyden Gray & Associates law firm. And we reached out to the Republican National Committee for somebody who could step in here to talk about the incoming administration's energy policy, environmental policy, and they pointed us to Ambassador Boyden Gray. Ambassador, thank you very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
You hear a very dire view of what may be coming on this front under a Trump administration. What are your hopes on environment and energy under the presidency upcoming of Donald Trump?
Well, I think the first thing that you have to remember is that for CO2 and climate change, I think the United States has reduced CO2 more than any other country over the last 10 to 20 years, largely because of the development in Oklahoma and elsewhere for the new technology to
natural gas.
Produce natural gas, which is very cheap and not totally clean of CO2, but much, much cleaner than coal or gasoline. So that's why we're doing much better than any other country, and we should continue to do better if this fracking revolution is allowed to continue. And then on the front of regular pollutants, that is the pollutants that kill today, not something that may happen 100 years from now, which is what climate change is about, for pollutants that actually kill today, we're so far ahead of the rest of the world. It isn't funny. They'll never catch us. You know, they've shut down driving in Paris today or this last week, because people are gasping for air because the pollution's so bad. I don't know, 500,000 people a year die in Beijing or in China because of the pollution so bad. That isn't happening here. It's not going to happen here. There was one liberal columnist over the weekend who said, you know, Scott Pruitt's going to make America gasp again. I mean, that's utter hyperbolic nonsense. I mean, it's just absolutely crazy. Most of these great advances at EPA have been produced by Republicans, from Nixon, who started the Environmental Protection Agency, to the Montreal Protocol, which Reagan negotiated, Reagan and Bush negotiated, which Ban Ki-moon at the UN said was the greatest international environmental treaty ever concocted, to the Clean Air Act amendments that you referred to that I was involved in. So, I mean, I just don't accept the notion that somehow Republicans are guilty of leading to catastrophe. It's just nonsense. What EPA is doing is pressing the envelope so far into every nook and cranny just for the sake of, almost nothing other than power. They want to pre-approve every modification of a schoolhouse, of a manufacturing plant, of a utility, sort of in advance, as a way of just maintaining and increasing their control over our lives, when we are living in the cleanest country in the world.
We're talking about the environment and energy policy under the Donald Trump administration, and it is a hot and hotly debated arena. Ambassador Boyden Gray, at the same time, many people are saying we're not on track to get out in front of climate change. We're at severe risk in terms of the implications of what that may bring. Why overturn the Clean Power Plan? Why threaten to pull out of the Paris Agreement now, when in spite of the advances that have been made, many scientists studying this are saying we're not making progress at nearly a fast enough clip, Ambassador?
Well, the Gina McCarthy, the administrator of EPA, herself said the Clean Power Plan is not about climate change, because it makes such a small, fractional change in the long-term prospects for what CO2 might be doing, about which we're not totally, totally sure. But she admits it's not about that. It's about, encouraging investments in clean power, whether it's wind or solar. And those are not going to go away. I mean, it's, George W. Bush, governor of Texas, later president of the United States, who started the wind program in Texas, which is the largest single wind-producing state in the world, I think even exceeding Germany. So, I mean, I don't know why this is not going to all be dismantled. Putin's not going to come in and dismantle all of these advances. The problem with the Paris Agreement, and I read the president's comments, or heard the president's comments yesterday, is saying, I'm studying the climate of the Paris Agreement. If this is walking back from an earlier speech, maybe it is, because I'm studying it. I'm looking at it carefully. The thing that bothers me is that some countries get huge advantage over us the way it's drafted, and they're eating our lunch. And that's true. China doesn't have to do anything until 2030. But here we are throwing everything you can think of at everybody who walks in this country. And no wonder plants escape to China and to India, because they're not regulated over there, but they're regulated up the wazoo here.
Bill McKibben, we just got a minute before the break. Ambassador, please tell me, Bill, a quick response to this perspective on the moment we're standing at.
The tell was when the ambassador said, oh, what CO2 might be doing, it's not totally clear. It is totally clear. This is the crisis of our time. And as he says, we're now backing away from any commitment, and it was a pretty minimal commitment to do anything about it. The U.S. has seen carbon dioxide emissions fall over the last 8 years. The reason, as he points out, is because in states like Oklahoma, we're fracking the heck out of things. The result has been a rapid rise in the amount of methane emissions. Those methane emissions are even more potent greenhouse gases. And as we see today, the big report today in the scientific literature, methane is spiking at an alarming rate all around the world. This is why we need to go to really clean energy, and we need to do it now.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Goldman Sachs. Get insights from some of the world's leading thinkers on markets, industries, and the global economy in the firm's podcast, Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on topics with far-reaching implications like climate change, autonomous driving, the future of China's economic growth, plus much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the incoming Trump administration and the environment. His pick, Scott Pruitt, to head the EPA, Kathy McMorris-Rogers to be Secretary of Interior, perhaps the CEO of ExxonMobil to be Secretary of State. Ambassador C. Boyden Gray is with us. He worked with President Bush the first, the second, on energy policy and is here today instead of the Trump administration on environment and energy. Bill McKibben is with us, author, environmentalist, founder of 350.org. They have been right in the forefront of pushing back against fossil fuel emissions, even pulling fossil fuels out of the ground. What do you see unfolding under Donald Trump on the environmental front? Here was Donald Trump, this was last September, on the Hugh Hewitt radio show, talking about climate change.
I'm not a believer in man-made global warming. It could be warming, and it's going to start to cool at some point. And, you know, in the 1920s, people talked about global cooling. Now it's global warming. And actually, we've had times where the weather wasn't working out, so they changed it to extreme weather, and they have all different names, you know, so that it fits the bill. The problem we have, if you look at, you know, our energy costs and all of the things that we're doing to solve a problem that I don't think in any major fashion exists.
A problem that he doesn't think in any major fashion exists. Now, maybe that line will soften, maybe not. Here he was yesterday on Fox News Sunday, asked whether he would pull out of the Paris Agreement.
Paris, I'm studying. I do say this. I don't want that agreement to put us at a competitive disadvantage with other countries. And as you know, there are different times and different time limits on that agreement.
Paris, I'm studying. C. Boyden Gray, what's he mean, times and time limits on the agreement? Is this what you're talking about with China not being required to fully kick in here until 2030?
Yes, primarily China. That's correct. They don't have, they're not even bound to do anything in 2030, but they say that's when they will level off. Now, what they're doing with this coal burning, you have to understand, it's a double or triple whammy against us. It allows them to subsidize products like aluminum, which are heavily electricity dependent.
Because of cheap coal energy in the production.
Yeah, and so the China comes dumping over here, running our aluminum companies out of business. But the coal use itself pollutes the West Coast. About a third of the fine particle pollution, which is the most deadly pollution that we have in this world, in California, comes from China. And we have to clean it up. It costs tens of billions of dollars. We have to clean up what China's doing. China's going to be able to do this until 2030 and maybe even beyond, while we're sitting here with our hands tied behind our backs. Now, I don't think anyone says we should raise CO2. It's still going to keep coming down because of the role of natural gas, and that is going to make it hard for coal companies, probably more than the regulations, or certainly as much as the regulations. And that is something we should, it's a tough call, but you've got to encourage it, and it's going to happen anyway because natural gas is very prolific and very common and very easy now to get to.
Of course, Bill McKibben points to the methane emissions there, which are a big deal in themselves. Bill, what about the economic argument here when it comes to addressing energy and environmental issues?
China's been reducing its coal use the last 3 years. Its coal use has gone down, and it is installing renewable energy faster than any place in the world. And they're doing it for two reasons. One, their cities are deeply polluted and they need their air to improve. Two, they understand the pickle that they are in with climate change. The Pearl River Delta, the center of their manufacturing economy, is a couple of meters above sea level. Their rivers, the Yangtze, the Yellow, depend on the glaciers in the Himalayas that are melting quickly. So the idea that the Republicans for generations now and some Democrats have been using the Chinese as an excuse to do nothing, but that excuse is evaporating. In fact, I think what's going to happen here is that leadership on this issue and probably on other issues in a discombobulated and isolationist foreign policy is going to pass to the Chinese. I don't think they're going to lead us quickly enough to get out of this problem, but it's very clear that the U.S. is no longer going to be playing a serious role internationally in dealing with the greatest global problem that the planet's ever faced.
I want to go to our listeners.
May I jump in here and just ask Mr. McKibben if he tolerates or countenances the continued dumping of PM into the West Coast thousands, tens of thousands of people a year. And
particulate material.
No. 350.org works in 185 countries around the world trying to bring down fossil fuel use, including in China, where we've staged hundreds of demonstrations. We think that China and every place else should be, and every country on Earth has now signed on to these Paris Climate Accords, and the Chinese have begun to reduce their use of coal. At the moment, the Chinese use fossil fuel in proportion per capita far, far less than the United States does. And historically, we remain the largest contributor of CO2 and methane to the atmosphere. So the idea that we should excuse ourselves in this country from doing anything because of the Chinese is a tired idea. And at any rate, physics doesn't care where the CO2 is coming from. We have got to cut it from every place.
See, Boyden Gray, if I may ask, I understand the economic concern. Every country has to look after its economy. At the same time, when the environmental risk here is so large, doesn't that then challenge the primacy of the economic debate that you're making here? If it's even a mortal threat globally, that's going to raise sea levels, wipe out the living space of millions of people, hit economies all over the place from the environment side. Doesn't that change the dynamic?
Well, again, I repeat, how many times I have to repeat it, the United States has reduced its CO2 more than any other country.
But the pace is not sufficient. There's a pretty clear consensus on that.
Let me just finish. Maybe the pace is not sufficient, but it's faster than anybody else, so we shouldn't be given such a hard time about it, seems to me. The point I'm trying to make is that when Congress tried, or the administration, I can't remember which one it was, tried to get an international treaty where China was not being put under the same rules as we are, it was rejected by a vote of 97-0. Now, it's just not, you know, you could never get Congress to adopt a program where China can go and do what it wants, while we're put under these very, very severe restrictions, which in fact, because we actually now produce less CO2, not per capita, but in aggregates, much less than China does.
But we industrialized first.
What happens with the Clean Power Plan is really just a drop in the bucket. If you don't cover India, China, and the bigger polluters, and do it on a level playing field at the same time, in concert, and not under different timetables that vary by two or three decades, if you don't do that, you are punishing the U.S. and you're increasing the pollution worldwide, because China doesn't put any controls, or hasn't put any controls seriously, on any pollutant. And as I say, they're now killing thousands of people in California.
Bill McKibben, is there a negotiating strategy here, Bill?
And yet the environmentalists in the United States think that's just fine.
Bill, is there a negotiating strategy here that could speed everything up ultimately somehow?
There's tons of things that we could do to speed everything up. I wrote a long piece this summer for the New Republic demonstrating in great detail how the incoming president, who is the first incoming president to have access to really cheap renewable energy, the price of a solar panel has dropped 80% in the last 10 years. If we wanted to, we could quickly and with enormous economic benefit build out renewable energy so that by 2030 we were powering most of the nation and most of the world that way. And as I say, that would have enormous economic benefit for everybody except the fossil fuel industry. But the fossil fuel industry, whose political contributions have powered the Republican Party and terrified the Democratic Party for a generation, are now in the driver's seat, and we're not going to see any of that. I mean, think about what it means that we're putting the head of the largest fossil fuel company on Earth in charge of the Department of State. I mean, any pretense that we're not a petrostate comes to an end if we go ahead and do that. The one good thing to be said about all of this is that from this point on, with no pretense, these guys own the future. If the climate disintegrates, and the climate is disintegrating, at the very least, we'll know exactly who to blame.
That's going to be pretty grim satisfaction if that's what happens. James in San Antonio, New Mexico. Thanks for calling. James, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I'd like to say that I don't agree with the ambassador. If the ambassador could look at his grandkids in the face, in their eyes, if he has any grandkids, and agree that we should not clean up our environment and blame China for everything that they're doing, well, I'm sorry for his grandkids. I live in the state of New Mexico, and we continue to build solar systems left and right. And I applaud New Mexico for being the leader, hopefully, in the Southwest as the poorest state in the country. And we're still pushing forward. Why can't the United States continue to push forward and not follow what the oil industry and the coal industry wants?
James, we've got a couple more, and we'll put it to him. Justin in Alpine, Texas. Justin, you're on the air.
Can I answer that?
Yes, sir. How are you today?
Very well. What's on your mind, Justin?
Oh, I was just a couple of comments that I agree with the ambassador 100%. And, you know, we are a very heavily regulated country already. We've taken care of our own. I am ecstatic that Donald Trump won the election. And, you know, the other gentleman from the college, I can't remember the...
Bill McKibben's here.
Mr. McGivens there sounds like he's just throwing up what Obama has fed him for 8 years, just like this whole country has been in the toilet for 8 years.
Oh, he was pretty tough on President Obama sometimes, Justin. But what do you mean? Are you not concerned about global climate change?
You know, no, sir, not particularly. I am not. You know, this country, everything is going to change anyway, whether it is, you know, too solar, too renewable. We're headed that way. Time will wean us off of fossil fuels, period. Everybody's trying to rush and rush and rush like we're going to die tomorrow, like this, Mr. McGivens is, you know, he sounds like it's just doom and gloom and we're all going to be burned in hell tomorrow.
Well, but what if it is really serious for our grandkids, as we hear from the New Mexican caller, Justin? What if it is that serious?
No, sir. It's not that serious. Like I just said, everything will change. You know, we're headed to solar. We're headed to wind. It's all up. It's producing. It's doing great. You know, everybody's just going to have to wean off and quit rushing and try. You know, they're just causing a big political storm doing this. It's going to happen. Just chill. Let it happen.
Justin, we've got it. Bill McKibben first to you, then Ambassador, I'll come to you. Bill, it's going to happen anyway. Let's just let it happen.
Just chill. Yeah, well, look, as I said before, this has always been a question about pace and about trajectory. We're way behind in this fight. That's what it means when more than half of the summer sea ice in the Arctic is gone. That's what it means when the oceans are 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago. That's what it means when we see forest fires in places we've never seen them before, 3, 4, 5 degrees of latitude north where they've ever been observed before. We're losing that, and we're going to lose it worse now because we're slowing. We're clearly, I mean, as everybody is saying, we're going to slow down the pace at which we make this change. And it's us that's slowing it down. I mean, the Chinese are producing more renewable energy than anybody on Earth, and they're moving more quickly in that direction than anyone on Earth. So it's particularly odd to be trying to scapegoat them. But in any event, everyone needs to shift. The Paris Climate Accords were the closest thing we had to everyone beginning to move in that direction. They were approved by the heads of state of every country on the planet. Our guy, Mr. Trump, who's announced that he's a really smart guy, so smart that he doesn't need to take intelligence briefings, apparently has decided that he knows more than all the climate scientists and all the other heads of state. So good luck to him and good luck to us all.
See, Boyden Gray, if the U.S. does pull out of the Paris Agreement, I mean, you may not like the timetable for some other countries in there, but at least there are commitments. If we pull out, they can pull out of their commitments too. Don't we risk ending up in a situation where it's back to free-for-all, and climate change proceeds apace, and we're really in trouble?
Well, I'm not the world's leading expert on every legal nuance of the climate of the Paris Agreement, but my understanding is it's basically not legally enforceable. There's some moral momentum to it, but it's not legally enforceable. So at the end of the day, I don't know what it really accomplishes.
Well, if it's the best we've got, why ditch it?
Well, I'm not. The president didn't say yesterday on television he was going to ditch it.
But he has said he would. I don't know where he stands now.
Yes, he said a lot of things which have been clearly walked back. And I think what he said yesterday is, after having listened to some experts on both sides, more than he had during the campaign, he's now said, I'm studying it, and what I'm worried about are the unequal treatment of different countries. And that's a perfectly legitimate question to raise, because the Congress of the United States and the people of the United States rejected a last effort that wasn't a level playing field by a vote of 97-0. And you can't do that to the workers of this country and force electricity prices higher and higher and higher so that plants locate go over and locate in China.
Bill McKibben, if we go down this road, you've led a lot of resistance already. If we go down this road, what's the resistance look like from the environmental movement?
People will do all that they can to resist. There'll continue to be lots of nonviolent protest of every kind. But I think that the real resistance, more and more, I think
environmentalists to resist. I mean, what I'm trying to tell you is that we have regular pollutants.
There's plenty to resist.
Regular pollutants. We have the cleanest country in the world by far.
Still, we have a problem. What would you do, Bill?
I think that a lot of the leadership for this resistance is going to come from scientists, because in the end, it's science and it's reason that's under threat here. We're moving into a fact-free future. The problem is that physics remains a fact, and physics is going to do what it's going to do unless we, no matter what Donald Trump says and no matter what he tweets, unless we do the things that we know that we need to do.
We will follow this issue. We will not stop. We're grateful to both of you for being with us today. Bill McKibben at 350.org, joining us from Middlebury College today. Thank you very much, Bill.
Thank you.
Ambassador Boyden Gray. C. Boyden Gray joining us from Washington. Thank you very much, Ambassador.
You're welcome.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.